Good afternoon to you all and welcome to this talk and to the series of talks that we will have over the next 3 months. This month, as Sonia mentioned, the theme is psychology, spirituality and meditation, in which we will explore the link between spirituality, psychology and the practice of meditation. We will take up some topics that have been of much interest in psychology, but also we will speak about the spiritual relevance and the spiritual implications of these topics. For example, today we will take up happiness, we will look at healing, we will look at forgiveness and self-esteem, some important things that are relevant in our daily life and have also been of much interest to psychologists in recent times. Shall we begin with a little bit of silence and some meditation? A couple of minutes. I will give you a brief meditation commentary. You can relax yourselves. Let the body relax completely. I let the body settle down. Letting go of all tension that may have accumulated in the body. I let each and every muscle of the body relax. Feel a wave of relaxation flowing from the top of the head to the tip of the toes. And in this relaxed state, I turn my thoughts away from the past. From the future. I turn them away from this external world of responsibilities and relationships. And I turn my attention within. Going deep within myself. Deep within, to the center of my being, to the center of the brain, I experience my entire existence merging, converging into a point. It is as though this entire world has disappeared. This body has also disappeared. All that remains is a point of light. A point. Energy. The soul, the spirit. A point of infinity. A point of eternity. Silent, blissful. Complete within itself. and I hold on to this stillness of the spirit. Holding on to the blissful experience. Of eternity, Shanti, which means I. The eternal spirit. I am originally an embodiment of peace. Peace is my original nature. Peace, my only religion. We begin with this these series of talks with a topic that is perhaps very close to the hearts of the whole of humanity: how to be happy. So we all want to be happy, right?
Yes.
Many other things we may not want, but we all want happiness, isn't it? When people do these surveys, value surveys across the world, across organizations, across professions, they ask people, what is it that you value the most? Out comes the reply, happiness. We all want to be happy. And of course, we have various ways in which we try to attain the experience of happiness. Usually when we look at the development of countries and nations, according to economics, we use the GDP, gross domestic product, right, to see to what extent have countries developed economically. That is an index of development that mostly people use. And so a few decades ago, psychologists wanted to find out, well, there is so much of material development in the world, what about the experience of happiness? After all, if cultures and countries and nations are becoming more and more developed, there are more and more facilities available for people, people should also be more happy. So many psychologists across the world, mostly in America, but also some in Europe, they did a lot of research trying to find out the relationship between economic prosperity and happiness. And they found something very interesting. They collected data for about 40 to 50 years. Since most of these people were working in America, the data was collected in America, but also there is data for the rest of the world. It is available on the internet. You can look for the World Values Survey and you will find lots of information on this. So the findings were very interesting. When they looked at America, the United States, we have some people here from the US here today. So we had some data from the United States from the 1940s onwards till the 2000. And after 2000, they found something very interesting. Though there has been a steady increase in the average GDP, gross domestic product per capita GDP, and even if you adjust it for inflation, so people will say, well, you know, the income is increasing, but so is inflation increasing. So what money could buy, what $100 could buy 20 years ago, it's not the same today. But they adjusted this for inflation. They factored in the techniques to do that. And they saw something very interesting. From the mid-1940s till the mid-2000s, there has been a steady increase in per capita GDP, steady increase in spite of adjusting for inflation. But the level of happiness is flat. You'll find this graph. So it's like, you know, the GDP is increasing, per capita GDP, and the level of happiness is flat. No change there whatsoever. Then other scientists try to explore, okay, how does this relate to the world? Looking at various countries, poor countries in Africa, in Asia, where people have great difficulty. How does it really work out that way? And then they found something interesting, that happiness and money has a little bit of correlation only for the very, very poor. But once a minimum level of living has been achieved, again, there is absolutely no correlation. So obviously, minimum food and shelter, maybe, that is needed. But once that is reached, there is no difference at all. And they found that other studies have been done, again, on happiness, comparing the level of happiness of the CEOs of the Fortune 500 companies and comparing their level of happiness with the Maasai herdsmen in Africa. No difference. Absolutely no difference. So this has been happening over the past few decades then. Okay, so if this is not contributing to happiness, what would it imply? It would imply that no matter how technologically advanced we may become, there is something else happening inside the human spirit that leads to the experience of happiness. And this has been a subject of debate for a very, very long time, not just in recent years. These researches are, of course, recent. But from the ancient times, from the time of the, usually philosophically we go back in the West to the ancient Greeks, right? In the East we may go back to some ancient universities in India, like Nalanda and Vaishali. In the West we go back to Greece. So from the time of Socrates and even earlier, people have been debating about happiness. So what leads to happiness? And Aristotle had come up with a very interesting model of happiness. Very interestingly, we see that a similar experience seems to be disclosed through current research. So when they speak of happiness, even at the time of the ancient Greeks, they spoke of two forms of happiness. One is hedonic happiness. And the other is eudaimonic happiness. Hedonic happiness obviously comes from the Greek word hedonia, which means pleasure, delight. And eudaimonia comes from the Greek word eudaimonia. Eu is positive, something positive. And daemon is like the good spirit within. So it's like being under the influence of the good spirits within, if you can call it that. So this was an understanding that people have had for a very long time, and you find similar understanding even in the East, in ancient Indian philosophy, though the words are different, but similar understanding. So there have been philosophers like Epicurus and many others in India, for example, who've spoken about pleasure being the highest good. Yeah? Pleasure is the highest good. And therefore, one would say hedonia. But their understanding of what leads to pleasure, long-term pleasure, was slightly different. So anyway, current psychology, past couple of decades, from the 1980s, 90s, and in the 2000s, the research that has been done on happiness, on human happiness, has been again centered around two experiences of happiness. One is called subjective well-being, or feeling happy in the moment, and the other is called psychological well-being. That is an experience of happiness that is more enduring, that is more long-term. So when we speak about subjective well-being, we are speaking basically about short-term happiness. When we are speaking about eudaimonic or psychological well-being, we are speaking about something that is more enduring and therefore long-term. So what does this mean? Short-term happiness would be the kind of happiness that you would get from indulgence. Indulgence in various sensual pleasures, good food, go for a nice vacation. Yeah, indulge yourself in the moment, you feel good. Listen to some nice music. Yeah, spend time in some good company, you feel good, you feel happy. Go for a nice jog, have a nice workout. various strategies that human beings engage in to make ourselves feel good in the moment. And I feel good. I feel fine. There's a song. I feel good. And then, of course, there is the other form of experience of happiness, which is more long-term. Here, it is not so much the question of indulgence, but here it's the question of meaning or purpose. Finding a sense of meaning in life. Finding a sense of purpose in life. And sometimes these two can actually be conflicting. Because to achieve a sense of meaning and purpose in life, sometimes we have to forego momentary indulgence. Right? Let's say a sportsman wants to develop his body, build up muscle in the body. And so in the morning, he has an alarm and he's kept the alarm. The alarm rings. And early morning, it's winter time, it's nice to just switch off the alarm and go back to sleep. Like, right? You feel so happy, right? Cozy up in the comforter and you go back to sleep. Another hour, another little indulging. But if I have set my aim, no, I'm going to work on this body, I'm going to make it stronger, I'm going to make it faster, I have to get up. I have to endure the discomfort of waking up in that cold morning, getting out of bed, putting on these clothes, going out in the freezing weather and beginning to jog, give the body some strength. It's hard work. But then if I am to discover a sense of meaning and purpose in my life, I have to do it. And at some time, and of course that may conflict with short-term indulgence, but then it leads to something that is more enduring, more sustainable, a sense of achievement, a sense of purpose. That gives a different kind of happiness, kind of fulfillment. So this is indulgence. There is meaning and purpose. Here in this kind of happiness, we would seek pleasure, avoid pain and discomfort. And here, of course, we understand that on the path of creating meaning, I have to sometimes embrace pain and discomfort as a part of my development. I have to endure, I have to tolerate, I have to take up many things. So if I've set a goal to become a doctor, I know I have to go through 5 years or 7 years of very hard work. That's one of the reasons why I didn't go to medical school. You see, I chose psychology. Easier. Originally, I wanted to go to medical school. Then I thought, oh my God, 5 years, and then another 3 years of master's, and like studying all the time, every day. And one of my friends, very good friends, he was a little senior to me, he really scared the daylights out of me. He was doing medicine. And he was saying, you know, how much I have to study? I said, how much? You know, even when I have to go to the toilet, I have to think, how much time am I going to spend? So 15 minutes in the toilet? No. Then I won't eat because then I have to go to the toilet. I'd rather study. I go, I don't want to live like that. Really scared. And of course, it's very, very competitive everywhere, I'm supposed, even in India. So anyway, but if I have set an aim that I have to achieve certain things, I have to take that pain and discomfort. So these are the two experiences of happiness. And so one can say this kind of happiness is more, I am taking happiness from the moment, from whatever is available to me. And in this form of a happiness, I am sort of constructing happiness. Through my actions, through my approach, I am constructing it by committing myself to a life that is more meaningful, that is richer. And research has shown that when we speak about people who experience a sense of autonomy, independence, people who are able to realize their capabilities and competencies, people who are able to have more long-term positive relationships, these are the kind of people who experience psychological well-being or eudaimonic happiness, more long-term happiness. So research has shown there are some 5 to 6 correlates of this kind of happiness. So how does one achieve this happiness? Very simple, just indulge yourself in the moment and you will find this kind of happiness. How does one achieve this kind of happiness? One, they say, is self-acceptance. Accepting the self, which all obviously would imply a clear understanding of the self, the positive as well as the negative, and self-acceptance. The second thing that they have identified is autonomy. The ability to work independently the ability to keep going in spite of difficulties that confront us, not giving up, having that sense of deep independence and autonomy. The third thing they have identified is positive long-term relationships. So even if there are difficulties, people endure in relationships. They have the ability to deal with relationships and to make relationships rich and richer in spite of all difficulties. So these are some of the aspects of eudaimonic well-being. So psychology has revealed then, if I want to experience more long-term sustainable meaning, a sense of happiness in my life in that way, I need to commit myself to a life of purpose, a life of meaning, which by implication would mean committing myself to a cause that is outside myself, a little bit larger than me. That means committing oneself to positive long-term relationships in spite of difficulty, enduring in those relationships. Which means doing the hard work of looking at myself in totality and working on accepting myself as I am, rather than trying to be something that I am not. Rather than trying to copy certain values that I have taken in from the external world. So these are the deeper implications of happiness. Okay. So now what do? We give up hedonic happiness and we move to eudaimonic happiness, is it? Let's work more deeply on ourselves. Now we will move to how do we understand this within a spiritual framework. Within a spiritual framework, which we will take up a little later, we see that there can be problems with both these forms of happiness if I approach them in a certain way. Let's take an example here. A few years ago, when I was working in the Middle East, I came across a girl. I was also doing some therapeutic work, so I came across a girl from America. Very nice, very capable young woman. She had finished her doctorate in chemistry, and very, very talented, and very brilliant. But she was at a point of time in her life where she was really in very serious depression. And even medicines were not helping, nothing was helping, and she was trying to figure out what is it that I need to do. So anyway, we started exploring her life, started trying to find out what happened, and it was a very touching story. So this girl comes from a very small town somewhere in America. I don't remember the name, but some small town in America. At a very young age, she loses her father, to whom she was very, very attached, and he was a very protective figure. Relationship with the mother was not that warm and all, but it was okay. But there was no big problems then. And then she reaches the age of about 15, 16, something like that. You know, people fall in love, so she falls in love with one of her classmates. And they have a very nice, a very long relationship for many, 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 many years. They sort of committed themselves to each other. They planned their future together. They plan how many children they want to have. They plan everything, you know, what young people do. What kind of wedding, the dress for the wedding. And everything is very nice, rosy picture of the future. So they were in this small town. And then after that, she moved out because she had to study. So she moved out to do her master's and then her PhD. And she went to one of these big cities, big American cities. And she moved into a big city, living in the university dormitory. And she was a pretty young girl. Obviously, lots of men were there to give a lot of attention to her. And so everybody asking her out and paying her a lot of attention. But she said, no, I'm committed. I have a boyfriend and I'm committed and, you know, we have planned everything. However, the temptation of indulging yourself in pleasure when it is available for you took over after some time. And she went and she had an affair with one person. Then she felt terrible. She went and told her boyfriend, I'm sorry, but this happened, and I'm sorry, it'll never happen again. Boyfriend, very, very painful for him, but he said, okay, what's happened has happened, let's forget it, let's move on. She goes back. After a couple of months, another infatuation, another affair, this one a little longer, She comes back and tells her boyfriend, I'm sorry, it happened again. He says, it's very, very painful for him. He says, okay, but, you know, I would still like to be with you if you still want to. She says, yes, yes, of course, we are committed. She goes back. 3 months, another infatuation. This time an even longer affair. Now, every time she is doing this, later on she was telling me, every time she is doing this, this is like, it seems quite natural. And the guilt that she felt initially, the second occasion and the third occasion, the guilt is even lesser. And then she decides, well, you know, this is not the kind of life I want to lead. Commitment is not for me at this point of time. So she goes and tells him, sorry, but I have to break up. There's someone else in my life. Now, this guy is totally shattered. 7 years. He's been waiting for her to finish her thing so he can marry her and all these things. So that relationship gets over. Life of indulgence. So I have actually committed myself to a relationship that is meaningful. Someone who has been a very strong support to me. And that has given me a lot of strength. But in the moment of indulgence, this seems much more attractive. Committing myself to a relationship and resisting the temptation, it's hard work. I fall into the temptation. And because I fall into this temptation in the moment, I end up damaging a relationship that was so strong and supporting for me. So she goes into another relationship. Very interesting. See, they say history repeats itself. So she goes into the next relationship with this other guy in this big city. Very nice. So they are together again for a few years. And then when it's time for her to do her PhD, she moves to another city. Now when she moves to another city, this relationship has now become long distance and there are more attractive alternatives there. Another charming boy comes along. Very, very attractive, very charming. He charms her. I said, what happened? What to do? I fell in love again. So the same pattern repeats. She falls in love with someone else, comes back and tells her boyfriend, I'm sorry, but we cannot go on. The guy is shattered. She's taking it as a part of life. So she goes now to this is another relationship. And this pattern repeated about 5 times. So there is one relationship she's committed herself to, and then someone else comes along, and then there is an overlap of a few months, and then she shifts. Another relationship, overlap a few months, and she shifts. And over a period of time, she actually stops feeling guilty. That's how life is. Monogamy is not human. It's not natural, isn't it? There are many theories about that. And this goes on, and then finally she ends up in another relationship with a boy. And then after a few months, this person decides to move away from her. And when that happened, she collapsed. Till now she's been moving away. And this time, he just one day, sorry, this will not work. And after that, she completely collapsed. And when she collapsed, somehow a deep realization came in her and she started remembering the pattern of her previous life. And then all the guilt that she felt that was suppressed came up. And that intense repentance at what she had done, especially to the first boyfriend, and then the second, and the third, and the fourth, all that emerged. And along with that, the feeling of being completely worthless, useless, good for nothing, serious depression, not able to function, not able to do anything. So this is what brings us to the third understanding, which is connected deeply to the spiritual understanding of the human self. If you look at it from the framework of many models in the world, they will say, well, you know, monogamy is not natural. We have evolved from the apes, from animals, etc., etc., and therefore it is not really natural. It is something that society has imposed upon us. From a spiritual perspective, we say, no, sorry. The quality, the original quality of the soul is purity. By implication, that means faithfulness and loyalty. And any time the soul goes against this deeply held value of purity, of loyalty and faithfulness, the soul is creating violence against itself. I may suppress it because it is painful, the feeling of guilt. I may push it out of my conscious mind, but it is there in the unconscious. It will keep bothering me, it will keep poking me, it will keep accumulating, 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 and one day it will just burst out. It can burst out in the form of a serious depression. It can burst out in the form of severe anxiety, and it can burst out in the form of a psychotic episode. All the repressed, pent-up feelings of the past, which I have not acknowledged, which I have not dealt with because they were too painful. I was more busy here. And so, obviously, committing myself to something more long-term requires hard work. Not just in terms of achieving goals, in terms of getting better grades or getting a better job, obviously, but also in terms of relationships. So, this can happen where we, because we are so much focused on indulging ourselves in the moment, we forget everything else and eventually end up causing so much pain for ourselves and for others around us. So obviously indulging ourselves in hedonic happiness just like that in the moment is not always wise. But what about committing ourselves to some long-term goals? Is that safe all the time, or are there problems associated with that as well? So I've committed myself, I said, no pleasure, nothing, I am fine, and I can be disciplined, and I can be strong, and I would like to discover meaning in my life. So how do I want to discover meaning in my life? Different people have different things. So for example, for me, meaning is in my work. Work is worship. Work is God. Work is everything. So I push myself, I work very hard. I commit myself to achieving those professional goals that I have set for myself. Anything wrong with that? Anything wrong with that? Yeah. In your experience, is there anything wrong with that? Do you think so?
Yes.
What is wrong with that?
You're only focused in one part, one way. You have to be more alive.
Okay. So, of course, we have to do something meaningful with our lives. If you don't do anything meaningful with our lives, how do I experience that deep sense of fulfillment? But in the process of doing something meaningful with our lives, if we get too much dependent on that particular, whatever I call, my purpose, my reason for existence, and if I'm focused on that completely, what happens when I'm unable to achieve it? It becomes a problem, right? And in this world, not everything is under our control. I think in recent years, in 2008, when the recent recession hit the world, many of us realized that. We might have done our work to the best of our ability, we might have committed ourselves, and then even the people lost their jobs. Not for any fault of theirs. There are so many things that are not in our control. And things can change. Even in terms of relationships, I may commit myself to someone very, very deeply, and I am loyal and faithful, but who knows? I cannot have control over the other person. So even in the form of committing myself to a life of meaning and purpose, if I am focused on the self, and if I get dependent on that, then obviously when that doesn't happen, when that happens, things work out fine. How do we understand whether we have crossed the line between a positive, healthy pursuit of purpose and meaning, and that line that tells us this has now become unhealthy? How do we distinguish between these two in your experience? So for example, I find a sense of meaning and purpose in helping others, and I work with, say, voluntary organizations, and I'm helping out people. I find meaning and purpose in my work, professional work, and I'm doing that. Good. It's something I'm doing which is larger than me. How do I understand whether this is a healthy pursuit, which will in fact lead to long-term happiness, or whether this has become a little unhealthy? What are the indications? What are the symptoms of the disease, as they say? Any experiences?
Just reviewing your...
Sorry?
Just gauging your happiness at that time and reassessing it from that perspective. And not just your happiness, but those around you that are close to you. Mm-hmm. And I think if you're constantly reassessing, then that will be something that keeps that in control.
Yeah. Someone else was saying something? You were saying something?
Yeah. But the experience of the conscience, and actually whether you have feelings of guilt in some way about what you're doing.
Okay.
Could be a way to judge.
Okay. So you mean to say that I am obsessing over a particular work or whatever it is because of some feelings of guilt, is what you were saying?
I think just if you're doing something that in some way you can feel that it's kind of to build up your ego or self-worth or something like this, and in a, it's not about what it is, it's about your kind of identity crutch or something.
Yeah, I think you hit upon a very deep point. When I start identifying, and what is wrong with identifying with work? Because when we identify with our work, with our activity, we do better. But as you said, this identification, when it takes the form of the ego, when I'm doing this, when I'm helping someone out, not because I'm helping someone out, but because by helping someone out, I get an ego kick. I feel good about myself. And if this shift of focus happens, rather than the person that I'm helping, if the focus is again the self, that I'm doing it because I'm feeling good about it, obviously there is a big shift. And one of the symptoms of such a shift is that there will be an experience of stiffness. There can be an experience of severeness in my actions. I become stiff. I become sort of obsessed. I have to get things done in a particular way. So I will say, well, yes, this is my life, this is my meaning, this is my purpose. But then the lightness and the easiness disappears. It is replaced with an experience of stiffness, seriousness, and severeness. It's like you're punishing yourself sometimes. And some people go to great extremes. Some people, for example, they work a lot, workaholics. They're working, working, working all the time. So yes, I'm taking the pain of hard work because I want to achieve something in the future. But in this process, my sense of balance has been lost. I don't know how it is to enjoy life. I don't know what it is to take simple pleasure in the moment. I've forgotten that. And I'm pushing myself, being severe, being serious. So after a certain point of time, that sense of tiredness comes over. I'm overwhelmed by tiredness. It's just too much. There is burnout in many cases. People become emotionally totally exhausted by that. So no matter which form of happiness we take, of course, and what are the symptoms? What is wrong in having good food? Anything wrong with that? Listening to good music? Nothing wrong with that, right? Going for a holiday? Anything wrong with that? Nothing wrong with that. But the same thing when pushed beyond a certain point, and there I have a complete lack of control. I want something, I want it now. There is very low toleration for not being able to satisfy my needs at that particular point of time. Psychologists say low frustration tolerance of frustration. So there is a lack of control, and I just go crazy all over the place. And where my sense of duty, my sense of responsibility has been taken over by my need for indulgence. So obviously, as such, nothing wrong with either of these things, but when they cross a line, obviously, there are implications for our well-being. So how do we bring about a transformation in the experience of happiness? How do we have a stage, how do we create a stage of balance where I'm able to take pleasure in the moment, happiness in the moment, without it resulting in a sense of lack of control? How do I continue to work on my life, on my career, on my relationships without becoming completely dependent on them? Where if they are there, as long as I am able to satisfy them, it's okay. But the moment there is a threat or there is a problem because of which I'm unable to satisfy these relationships or I'm unable to fulfill these goals I have kept for myself professionally, career-wise, there is again a sense of frustration. How do we go about doing that? And this is where we come to the spiritual perspective of another dimension of happiness. We can call it spiritual, or we can call it transcendental. This is a very different experience of happiness, and a lot of Current research in psychology, interestingly, is now touching upon that. Because now psychologists are also recognizing that, okay, so we have said initially, if I just focus on indulgence, it's a problem. I will not experience long-term happiness. For experiencing long-term happiness, I have to make this shift and commit myself to something that is larger than myself, commit myself to a larger cause. But then they're understanding that even this, as this, can lead to a form of dependence. And when it leads to a dependence, as long as I'm able to satisfy, when there is satisfaction of either of these, there is the experience of happiness. But obviously, when there is no satisfaction, then there are experiences of frustration and tiredness, etc., etc. So they recognize this. What is the way out? And that's where, in my understanding, spirituality comes in. Because in, spiritually speaking, happiness is more than just hedonia or eudaimonia. Happiness is something that can be experienced as a state of being. Happiness is something that can be experienced and constructed from a space that is totally different. That is not based on either indulgence. It is not based on the construction of meaning through some activity or relationships. But it is a state that is created from deep introspection through the processes of meditation. And it is a state that comes from an experience of deep inner fullness. And the practice of meditation, as far as we experience it in Raja Yoga, that is the system of meditation that we practice, for those of you who are here for the first time, the focus is on creating the state of fullness within. That state of fullness that is not completely independent from these, but at the same time, it is something that is working from a different space. I work on this, on creating the state of fullness, and when I am able to experience the state of fullness, then happiness flows from within. And then because happiness is flowing from within, and I experience the state of fullness, I experience a certain psychological distance from both this experience of happiness as well as this experience of happiness. And because of that psychological distance, I can see what to do when. Otherwise, sometimes going, you know, giving yourself pain can go into great extremes. I'm dependent on my work to give myself a sense of meaning. I work long hours. My wife is complaining, my kids are complaining, it doesn't matter because my work gives me meaning. I go totally out of balance. I get pleasure in some indulgence, whatever it is, some food. And then I know that this food is not good for my health, but then I just lose all sense of balance. And I binge myself, I indulge myself and give my body all sorts of problems. Because there is a dependence. And as we understand it, this dependence obviously is there because we are operating from a space of inner spiritual emptiness. A spiritual emptiness, as we understand, can never be filled up by something physical in the world outside. And whatever I am taking in, it is like compensating for something that is lacking within me. And I keep doing it, and I keep doing it. It never fills up, and I keep doing it again and again and again. Like in psychoanalysis, they say, you know, children who overeat, who put on a lot of weight, they have a kind of an oral fixation because the needs for whatever, according to psychoanalysis, certain needs have not been satisfied in childhood. And the sweet and the cookies and the cakes are by association a symbol of sweetness, of love. And I'm taking it in, taking it in, taking it in to fill in that emptiness that I'm feeling inside, which has never been filled up by love. So it need not be with food. It can be with education, it can be with work, it can be with helping others, it can be with anything. And when I'm working from a state of emptiness, even if I don't want to, I will become dependent. I may understand this intellectually, that no, I'm getting dependent, I'm feeding my ego. I understand this, I'm sleeping late, I need to get up, I need to work on my body, I need to give myself some exercise. Intellectually, I understand it. But the feeling of inner emptiness is so deep, it is beyond the intellect. The very deep feelings, it takes over complete control. And even though I want to break these dependent habits, whichever way they may be operating, I am unable to. And I keep falling back into old patterns again and again and again. Going back to this girl I was speaking to you about. She's telling me later on, every time I would feel myself attracted towards someone else, I would feel, no, this is not right. There is someone else who I've committed myself to. She would feel that. That initial understanding would be there, but the temptation was so strong. She would just give in. And the same pattern would repeat again and again and again. We've all done this. Keep an alarm in the morning and go back to sleep. Because the temptation of just cuddling up on bed is so strong, we just give in. So we may intellectually understand many things, but if I have not worked deeply enough to transform my inner experiences of the self, it will be difficult to break these patterns. So I will keep indulging myself in happiness, be it hedonic, be it eudaimonic, and I will keep getting trapped again and again and again, and the same cycle repeats again and again and again and again. I've worked with people who have like kept changing jobs very, very frequently. Even though they were not fired, they would keep changing jobs and they would never find happiness in their job. And by the way, there is a very interesting study on job satisfaction and personality. And there was a study carried out on thousands of people, again in the US, where most of these studies are done. But anyway, they found something very interesting. So there were people who were interviewed in, say, 1969, I think the year was, some people who were considering leaving their jobs because they were not happy with their jobs. And so they interviewed thousands of people, and some people were not happy with their jobs, some people were happy with their jobs, and some people, because they were unhappy with their jobs, they left the job. Wonderful. After a year, they were interviewed again. They changed their jobs, some of them a few times in a year. Are you happy with your job? Not happy even now. And then the same study was repeated on the same population after 10 years. The people who were unhappy in 1969 were equally unhappy in 1979, after having changed many jobs. And the people who were happy in 69, even though they changed jobs or they did not change jobs, they were equally happy in 1979. Just changing the job will not fix the problem. Sometimes it may. But that's not the point. We may change jobs for various reasons. But if I'm anchoring my happiness on my work, the likelihood is that I will never find it there. Because there I am using work to feed some emptiness inside me, which can never be filled up in that way, no matter how hard I try, because that emptiness is coming from a different space. So then, the practice of Raja Yoga meditation here tries to give us another way where we move away from both indulgence and meaning and purpose. We move to a different level. And from that different level, from a spiritual understanding of the self, I go deep within myself and I connect with the inner spirit. I connect with the Supreme. I connect with God. And in that relationship with a higher reality, I try and fill that inner emptiness of the spirit. And as that starts slowly filling up, I feel the experience of fullness. When I feel the experience of fullness, I can see that there is a distance between me and my activities, between me and my roles, between me and that holiday. Otherwise, that holiday is so important for me. If the holiday doesn't work out, I feel, I can be destroyed. I've been planning for this holiday for so long. Now what to do? There is a sense of distance between me and my job, me and my role. There is also a sense of distance between me and my qualities. Many a times, we find a sense of meaning and purpose through using our qualities. So, some of us are very analytical. Some of us are very naturally very caring. These are qualities that are a manifestation of the spirit. But when these qualities become my identity, again, I'm feeding my ego. I'm feeling good through indulging myself in those qualities because I believe they give me a sense of meaning, which is all fine. But the problem is when I get dependent on it, I have trouble again. So that psychological distance will also give me a distance from my own qualities. And therefore, if I'm able to use these qualities, it is good. If I'm not able to use these qualities, I don't get upset. Because they are there within me. When it is required, I will use them. That gives us a sense of balance, and that is what we try to create in the experience of meditation. Okay? Does it make sense? Would you like to ask some questions? Any questions? Yes?
I think it's interesting. You speak very well about long-term relationships. And I understand what you're saying, but, you know, sometimes it feels not right. So when, how to decide?
How to decide?
Yeah.
I'll give you another case. This is someone I met here in Denmark. Yeah? So this lady, and... married to one man, nice, decent, happy marriage. They have a son together. And after a few years, it's not unhappy, but it's not really happy. So they're like sitting at home watching each other's face, wondering what to do, or watching television, you know. Or one is reading a book in that corner and the other is reading a book in this corner. Life is getting a little boring. Yeah? So what do? Being a very nice, friendly couple, they sit down and they have a talk about it. And they say, maybe it's time we go our different ways. Why? Things are not working out. Why are they not working out? Because it's a little boring. That's all. Nothing else. No one has betrayed anyone. Nothing. And they have a son, but, you know, it just doesn't feel right. You see? It doesn't feel right. I should trust my feelings after all. So they learn to trust their feelings, and you should trust your feelings. It doesn't feel right. So why should I do something when it doesn't feel right? So they decide, okay, let's move away. And then they decide to split up, and then the poor son traumatized. What happened? Yesterday they were together and all of a sudden, no fight, no quarrel, nothing. What had happened? The poor chap is confused and totally traumatized. But anyway, they want to have a little more fun in their life, these grown-ups, the small boy. So they split up, and then this man goes his way, this lady goes her way. After a few years, I think it was just a little over a year, she finds someone else. It felt right again. It felt right. So they enter into a relationship and they get married. But of course, because they have a son, she has to keep meeting her ex-husband frequently. So they keep meeting because they have a son and they talk and they remain friends. And after some time, they become such good friends, even deeper than they were when they were married. And then she starts regretting her decision. And then she was telling me, you know, I think I made a mistake. It's too late now to change it. Now I can't break up with him and then go back to my husband because now he's found someone else, so it's too complicated now. But she said, if I had just waited for 2 years, nothing had happened. I was in a hurry to feed myself with all the happiness that I imagined the world had to offer me. But if I had just been patient, waited for 2 years, I could have stayed in that relationship. And we are such good friends today. So just because things feel right or feel wrong, it doesn't mean anything really. Our feelings may come from a space of our ego. They may come from a space of emptiness. So how do we know whether we are doing something wrong? This is probably one indication that nothing is wrong. Why do I want to move away from this relationship to which I am committed? I think that's a question I can ask myself. What is wrong? Problems will come in here. Then what happens is many cases I have seen, people keep repeating patterns and say in relationships again and again. Like this example that I gave about this girl, the same pattern. You see? First time you're committed, you have temptation, there is a conflict, you give in to the temptation. Okay? Then you say, no, this feels right. Okay, now you're in this relationship. And then what happens again? The same thing. After some time, after a few years, same temptation comes in. It doesn't feel right, this feels right, change. Third time, the same pattern is repeating because it was never resolved in the first place. And so I end up causing so much of damage, so much of trauma for myself as well as for the other person, ending up damaging my own sense of self-worth and self-esteem, going against my own sense of inner spiritual morality, not cultural morality. We are not speaking about cultural morality here. We're speaking about a deep inner spiritual morality. From a spiritual perspective, we say every soul has a moral, measure. The conscience. And if I can ask myself honestly, I will get the answers as to what is right and what is wrong. And if I go against my own inner conscience, obviously I end up damaging myself. And so I may get short-term happiness in whatever it is that I'm indulging myself in, but over a period of time, I end up destroying my own sense of self-worth and my own sense of happiness and the possibility for enduring happiness in my life. Enduring happiness requires sacrifice, it requires discipline, it requires commitment. It requires facing the challenges, difficulties, relationships, differences of opinion, differences of personality. It will always be there, no matter which relationship I go into. And if I do not resolve them here, they will keep coming again and again and again in my life. And so we end up with the problem of the modern world, where people are floating from one to the other, one to the other, one to the other. Nothing is holding together, everything is falling apart. You see, in the world of the family, social support systems are falling apart. The more we give in to these momentary indulgences, the more the social support systems are falling apart. More the small children who are caught between these whims and fancies of the parents are getting more and more traumatized. More and more difficulty, being dragged from one home to the other, one home next weekend, next home one weekend. And imagine what is happening to these small kids. So, if I can move then to that experience of happiness which comes from deep within, which is spiritual and which is transcendental, then I will learn how to bring about a balance between these states. So I can learn to take pleasure in the moment without letting it going out of control, where I can learn to commit myself to something that is larger than myself in terms of work, career, without getting dependent on it. Where I do my best here, I also know how to enjoy life. And from this experience of happiness, there is an enduring sense of easiness and lightness in my work. So I will not make a big deal about my work. Yeah? Some people make a big deal about small things. This chair has to be arranged in this particular way. It can't be this way. If it is this way, anxiety, I have to put it back. What is coming out here? Again, you know, that simple activity of having something in order has taken over. And I'm using that as a compensation for something that is lacking deep within me. So these obsessions and compulsions, in more extreme cases, of course, we have psychological disorders. The same thing, we all have our obsessions and compulsions. And push them to the extreme, you end up having an obsessive compulsive neurosis. Isn't it? So, any other questions? Yes. Yeah, yes.
Didn't the Buddha leave his family and give up everything and all that?
Very good question. How do I answer that? No, I'm trapped. But there is an answer to that. But I'll take it later. You had something to say?
As far as meditative state and being able to see where you stand in relationship to those two, doesn't meditative state itself provide some sort of enlightenment, or is it just that you stop and be observant? I'm not sure. Is the meditative state enough to enlighten your own situation?
Your question is, does a meditative state lead to an enlightenment of your present situation, your present predicament? Or, what was the second part of it?
Or do you need to...
You need to first understand...
the meditative state, then seek enlightenment? Or are you finding enlightenment in the meditative state?
Okay, so finding enlightenment in the meditative state and then going into the meditative state And then seeking enlightenment, or finding understanding and then going into the meditative state? Is this
well, I guess what I don't know is I'm just asking if the meditative state itself provides some enlightenment.
In my understanding at least, which is of course heavily colored by my understanding and practice of Raja Yoga, which is what I know, the meditative state itself does provide enlightenment. Because when I am able to get deep inside within myself and touch that spiritual core, the spirit, the soul, and when I can connect to the Supreme, to God, that in itself leads to certain experiences where I begin to experience myself as a peaceful being. Where I begin to experience myself as a pure being. And that experience then deepens my faith that yes, I am peaceful originally. Yes, I am pure originally. And that faith then leads to the manifestation of these qualities in life in terms of loyalty, faithfulness, integrity, etc. So there is that angle to it as well. However, in Raja Yoga, we also understand that at the same time that I am practicing the meditation, going into the meditative state, I also have to make sure that my daily activities are in alignment with my spiritual self. So, for example, In meditation, I sit down and I tell, okay, I'm peaceful, I'm pure, blah, 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 all these very nice things, and I feel good about myself. And then I'm trying to save on taxes. Illegally or dishonestly. Then I'm committing an act that is actually against my inner value. And so after having committed such an act, I try and experience that state. My intellect will not accept that. Because my actions have not been aligned with my spiritual nature. So we need to do both. We need the practice of meditation, but we also need living spirituality every day. So for example, I'm getting angry. Okay, the soul has become weak and we get angry. And I give in to the anger. I shout or I abuse or I take revenge on someone. And then I sit and I tell myself, I'm a loving being. It won't work. So when I feel angry, then it is my responsibility to go deep into the meditative experience and transform that anger. And it is possible. It is possible. It takes hard work, but it is possible. We will also look at some of these things later. So it is both. The meditative state itself can give us an enlightenment. On the other hand, my actions also need to be aligned to my spiritual understanding of the self. And therefore in Raja Yoga, many times we say meditation, but meditation is really only a part of Raja Yoga. Raja Yoga is living a life of unity. Yoga is unity. Raja is the king or a leader. So leading a life in unity with the self, leading a life in unity with God, leading a life of unity, which is not just in meditation, but in my daily actions. And then comes transformation, then comes a more enduring experience of happiness. Your question was?
Yeah, there are these ideas of giving up everything.
Yeah, giving up, yes. The other aspect of Raja Yoga is that, at least in the philosophy, there are many spiritual philosophies in the world and there are many meditative practices in the world. In the philosophy of Raja Yoga, we have no concept of renouncing family, work, and going away anywhere. That is not a practice of Raja Yoga. And honestly, when I started, I explored various systems of meditation. When I stumbled across Raja Yoga, this was one of those things that really touched my heart very deeply. So, you know, I don't have to let go of my responsibilities, say, towards parents or towards family. I don't have to do that. In fact, I have to fulfill them. In Raja Yoga, the understanding is whatever my responsibilities are professionally, in terms of work, in terms of career, in terms of using my own abilities for the benefit of the world around me, I have to do them, and I have to do them well. That's living spirituality. Otherwise, what's the point of spirituality? It's easy to go and be a hermit and be peaceful when I have no responsibilities. Raja Yoga is a life of... That's why it's called Raja Yoga. A king has many responsibilities. Raja is a king, and a king has many responsibilities. A king has a whole kingdom to look after. So the king runs away, who's going to look after the kingdom? So my kingdom, my world, my mind, my thoughts, my actions, my responsibilities, my relationship is my kingdom. I can't leave them and run away. I have to be there, take care of everything, and yet maintain. But that is possible when I move to this spiritual transcendental level, which of course in the terminology of Raja Yoga we say soul consciousness. The consciousness of being a spirit, holding on to the identity of being a spirit. Yes.
Does it take a long time before you can get such an experience of being a soul?
Not necessarily. I think different people have different experiences. I remember for me, the very first time I meditated, I had a very deep experience of being a spirit. But then it never happened for many months after that. So, for many others, nothing happens in the beginning, but they sort of start feeling it gradually over time. So I think we are all at different points in our journey in life, and different people can experience it differently. It can be immediate, it can take some time, but you know, perseverance, we keep doing it and slowly, slowly it starts developing. And how do we know it is developing? There will be the sense of easiness and lightness in all our actions, where we will be able to take pleasure in the moment and enjoy and have a little fun, at the same time not get carried away by that, you know, where we know we have work, we have responsibilities, we take care of them without again getting very stiff and serious and obsessed with that. We take care of that. The moment, and this I think happens over a period of time, and slowly, slowly we start feeling that sense of detachment, not running away. Detachment does not here means moving away from responsibility, but detachment means that psychological distance from our activities, from roles, from our own qualities. We're able to see them at a distance, use them when necessary. If not necessary, I can also be comfortable doing nothing. Okay? So, shall we stop here today? We'll have a little experience of meditation again to wind up. We have about 10, 12 minutes. Unless you have any other questions you would like to ask? Any last? Okay. So, in the next talk that we will take up, we will go into the experience of healing. And that obviously has implications for this experience of emptiness and for the experience of fullness. Because the emptiness has been created because of certain experiences of obviously of the past. And unless and until these experiences are healed, the experience of fullness can become a little difficult, which would then of course lead to the experience of balance and transcendence. So we will go into the experience of deep inner healing in the next session. Okay, yeah, it will not be next week, it will be the week after next. So not the coming Friday, but the Friday after that, that is 16th. Okay? So let's have a little experience of meditation. I think Sonia has already announced, my Danish is not so good, but we have meditation courses, for those of you who have not done them, we have meditation courses beginning every month in Danish, and every other month or so in English, for those of you who cannot speak Danish. So those of you who are interested can just look up the website or send an email to Sonia, and you know, you will be informed when the courses are to go deeper into the experience of meditation. Okay. I let the body relax once again. Letting the body relax once again, I move my attention away from the world outside, the world of my responsibilities, relationships, activities. And I turn my attention within. Withdrawing myself from the experiences and sensations of this physical body. I go deep within myself. Deep within to the center of my being. to the center of my existence. The soul, the spirit, that energy which was before this body was, that which will be after this body is no more. I experience my entire existence merging into a point. A point of light. A point of infinity. A point of eternity. It is as though this physical body and this physical world has disappeared. All that remains is the spirit, the sparkling star, spreading rays of peace, and stabilized in this awareness of my spiritual self. I feel myself slipping away from this physical world . I see myself traveling through a tunnel of light, going beyond space, beyond time. And as I emerge onto the other side of this tunnel, I see myself in a world of light. The invisible dimension. The eternal home of the spirit. And in this realm of light, I see myself surrounded by a multitude of other beings of light, sparkling stars, my family of humanity. And in the midst of all these sparkling beings of light, I see one being exceptionally bright, spreading rays of infinite peace. Blissful happiness. I come closer and closer to this being of light until I am completely absorbed in his light. The light of the Supreme. The light of God. A point of infinity. just like the soul. The infinite source of peace and power. Feel the light of the Supreme entering the soul, filling up the empty spaces within, healing, purifying, transforming. Returning the soul to its original state of fullness, completeness, blissful happiness. And I hold on to this deep, filling silence. Experiencing myself to be a spirit in the presence of the Supreme. In the invisible dimension, beyond space and time. Just two sparkling stars, two beings of light, silent, peaceful. And holding on to this deep, filling silence, I let myself gently return back to this field of action of the body, back to this room, back to this body, and once again I take my place behind the eyes, in the center of the brain. I, the eternal spirit, the eternal actor, play my part through the physical costume of the body, spreading the light of peace, the light of life, throughout the brain and the body. Silent and peaceful. At peace with myself. At peace with the world.